We're back and right on schedule. This is the Gray Zone.
Zach's back.
You're not?
Ah. Mentally half here, half not here. But let's see if you can stimulate me to be more engaged than I'm currently feeling here, Zach.
Do you think the gaps are going to get longer between each episode?
Probably.
Do you think it's going to get worse and worse, or we're ever going to get back into a flow?
This is how the whole thing peters out.
No, honestly, don't say that.
I've talked about every topic I can think of. I got nothing left unless you want to talk about
recreational programs here. The well is dry. We've exhausted all of your knowledge.
Yeah. It's now a recreational podcast for recreational coaches.
I mean, you know what? I have a bad quality where I get a little snobbish about that sort of stuff. I think like that stuff keeps the engine of tennis running. Like,
right.
And you become such a better coach by doing that sort of coaching, like 100%. coaching lower level players and less serious players. Like, you learn so much about yourself as a coach.
100%. And or just, it's always like, I say this about competing too, and why I should still compete more. Cause I think when you don't work with like introductory level players or you don't compete frequently, it's easy for coaches to lose sight of like how difficult tennis is.
That's such a good point. Do you compete a lot?
I used to play weekly leagues and stuff.
Yeah, okay.
I would find a partner like Ryan Chow who could absolutely just carry the crap out of me. Pretty much if I found a partner who could who like if I made one return in a return game, we had a chance to break.
Yeah.
So that's like, yeah. That's how I'd pick them.
Cuz I played a match this year or like sometime in the last 12 months.
No way.
But it was not like a competitive match, like a practice match.
Okay, yeah.
But that's still a match. Like, it's more than usually I would play a set, maybe. Yeah. Max. But I played two sets in a match tiebreak.
Yeah.
And then I played a two set match in like a coach's tournament in BC, probably, you know, 3-4 years ago.
Yeah.
And like, that's maybe all of the matches. I mean, I'm sure I've played a few practice matches like in the early years when I was starting out coaching, but like, yeah, since my junior career, that's essentially all I've done. And I'm kind of ashamed to admit that, because I feel like...
Me too. Yeah.
Like, well, don't go me too when you've played 10 times more than me. You can't lump your... Okay, recently. Yeah. But I mean, like, to. I... Because I think... Yeah, I completely agree. Like, you... And you can empathize with the athletes so much more when you get in that position and just like... When you get in their shoes and like push yourself physically and push yourself mentally and compete, and you realize you feel the stress and you feel the emotion and you feel the frustration of like feeling like you own that shot, but you can't get it. Like,
yeah,
it's so beneficial, but I just don't have the time / energy / willpower to force myself to compete regularly.
Yeah. We're going off on a tangent, but I was convinced that when I reached over 35, which was last year, that I was going to start playing over 35s.
Mm.
It just didn't happen, but I would really like to. And then the other thing I'd say, too, is I also find that's why parents who haven't played a competitive sport or specifically competitive tennis just have such a tough time appreciating psychological challenges that kids go through. Because, like, really, yeah, if you don't know or haven't experienced it, it's so tough to know what it feels like and also to not understand it. Like, I think it's so easy to not understand what the player is feeling.
Yeah.
Unless you've been there.
Oh, definitely. And I think, too, I wonder, too, sometimes if the athletes can also, like, if you're not competing, can feel like, you don't know what I'm going through. Cause like, of course they know that you've been through this, but if you went through it 20 years ago, it's like, I think it can be easy for them potentially to be like, you don't relate to me. I've always thought it'd be interesting to like take up another sport at semi-competitively. Of course you don't have time to do it as a high performance athlete, but to like pick up another sport and be like, I'm going to dedicate 8-10 hours a week to this. And like train and like work to get better. And then you can sort of like go along the journey with your athletes, even if it's a different activity.
That wicked.
I think it'd be a cool idea. It takes a lot of time, but.
Yeah. I used to, a couple of years, this is okay, a few years ago, me and some buddies played like in a recreational beach volleyball league. And A, it was like the most fun ever. But B, it's like when you don't take it seriously, like when you're not, there's no pressure to perform. There's no like psychological pressure to perform, which is useless in tennis. But I just found like, playing somewhat competitive beach volleyball was just so fun, because even if you miss, you're just like, hey, we're playing sports, y'all.
That's possibly like my biggest challenge and something that I'm not sure I've mastered, is like the ability to play something competitive without deciding the next day that I want to be number one in the world at it, which is a statement that reveals a lot, because I'm not number one in the world at anything. But like, almost virtually every activity I take up, there is a significant part of me that after the first day is like, I wonder if it's possible that I'm a prodigy and a late bloomer and I could be like professional at this. Everything I do, I'm
Exactly.
like, I wonder if it's possible.
And then
And
there's a guy like John Kajurski, who's a great coach, but he's like rock climbs, and then all of a sudden he's like, this is my identity. And then he plays frisbee golf for the first time. He's like, no, this is my identity. And I love that about him, man. He's just like, he's so good at like having hobbies. And like, how does he do it?
You were harassing me about hitting record before we actually started the podcast and the amount of dirt and trash talking that I've gathered on you. And now you're doing the trash talking on the podcast.
Right. That's right. Yeah. All
Oh,
right. I
yeah.
guess we should get on with it, huh?
Oh, yeah. We have to follow a strict agenda here, Al.
Yeah.
On the topic of players buying into you and believing or empathizing with you or you empathizing with them. I'm sure we've talked about the general notion of leadership at some point in the last however many episodes, because I mean, it's a pretty broad topic. It's a word that I've grown a little skeptical of, I guess. Not skeptical is the wrong word, but it's just like it can mean so many things to different people, and it's such a broad term, and it's a very tricky one to define. But I think it's interesting to talk about because, well, it's so important. We're leaders, and leadership, I think, has this sort of multiplier effect on everything else that you do. Your ability to coach in competition, your ability to develop skills, your ability to sell things. It all comes down to leadership, or it doesn't come down to that, but it's all influenced by your leadership skills and your qualities as a leader. And so I think it's always interesting to hash things out around that and see how we can be better leaders. But it wouldn't be a gray zone episode without starting with a question. So I'm going to throw it over to you and ask you what is leadership to you? What do you think are the qualities of a good leader as a coach? What do you think are the key abilities of a leader? Your thoughts, Al.
So I feel like I should nail this answer because we just gave a presentation on like these core principles to a group of coaches.
Did you?
Kind
That's
of, yeah.
good timing.
But with that, I don't know. As you said, it totally depends on the context in which you're talking about leadership. And I guess I'll just speak to like my own beliefs. I think first and foremost, a leader is somebody who embodies the adjectives that they would like their club or their players or their program to really run with. So I think like there's a lot of leaders who suggest that they are X, Y, and Z, but maybe don't embody that. And one thing that I'm trying really hard to do is like if I say some characteristic is important to our club or our program, I have to live that every day. And I can't expect others to do it if I don't do it. So did I answer your question? Absolutely not. I just told a story about myself. Want to try again?
But so you're saying leadership is about embodying the qualities that you want to see in the program,
Yeah, let me
right?
try that again. I think one of the things that being a good leader is living out the values that you believe in every day. And if like as a leader, if I don't do that, I can't hold anybody else to any sort of standard that is like above or beneath that. You know, it's like it's got to come from the person at the top, and you can't expect people to run through a wall for you if you're not showing those things every day. And that's only top of mind for me because I've realized one of our coaches had a kid, which is great. So I've been on court more than usual over the last 2 weeks. And A, I've realized like how quickly you can lose some coaching skills if you're not actively practicing them. And then B, it's like I feel an obligation to work harder than or work as hard as the expectations that I might have for a program. I explained all that really poorly, Zach, so you can cut that too,
No,
but.
but I no, but I get what you're saying. And the good news for you is that it ties in with one of these academic-y models of leadership. Because I'm talking about it going through my master's, and one of the models, one of these phrases you've probably heard is transformational leadership. Have you heard this?
Heard of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's another sort of model, and they contrast it with transactional leadership, and the idea is like transactional leadership is very much about like you give me this, I give you this in return,
Got
right?
it.
So it's like you give me this amount of money, I give you a 1 hour lesson,
Right.
and it's very transactional as opposed to transformational leadership being more about the person and transforming their life and helping them in various ways and being a little bit more difficult to measure. But one of the you know there's some consensus, or I think part of the model anyway of transformational leadership is what they call these four I's. And so they're idealized influence, inspirational motivation, intellectual stimulation, and individual consideration. And so
Interesting.
just put very simply is like idealized influence is exactly what you're talking about, is like being a role model essentially, right?
Yeah.
And then it's inspiration, so then it's motivation. So being a role model, inspirational motivation, which I think speaks for itself, intellectual stimulation, so like challenging people. And then individual consideration is like being adaptable or adaptive to the person, and like feeling like you treat each individual as their own person.
Yeah. Do you want to speak a bit more on the one about like the intellectual stimulation one as it relates to challenging somebody? Because that can be challenging with a staff if your staff is not aligned to want to be better in a sense.
I can't really speak to it. I'm not an expert on it, on transformational leadership. But what I'll say is this, is that as you know, I'm a structure guy, so I'm just looking for different definitions and different ideas from people that can put some clarity on the idea of leadership. And one of the resources I go to, I've mentioned maybe once before on the podcast, maybe not, is this body of research by these guys, Cliff Mallett and Sergio Lara Bercial. And they essentially did a multi-year research project on what they called serial winning coaches. And so these were coaches who had won multiple either Olympic medals or world championship medals with over an extended period of time with different athletes or teams. So these were coaches who had really demonstrated success at the highest level of the game, not just luck. And this was any sports. And they interviewed them. There are, I think 17 coaches, and I think they interviewed 8 or 10 athletes, maybe a few more, the athletes that these coaches had coached. And there's a lot of really interesting findings. I encourage anyone to look into it. I'm sure it'll come up more on the podcast. But one of the terms that they coined in reference to leadership was this idea of caring determination. And they sort of said that that was what these serial winning coaches embodied, was caring determination. So it's this sort of duality of like, I care really deeply about you as a person, but I'm also very determined to achieve success and to push you and to strive for excellence. And so in the
Interesting.
determination front, because you had asked me about, the intellectual, the stimulation piece, in the determination front, they listed five sort of aspects of that these leaders demonstrated. And they were focus, commitment, standards, modeling passion, and resilience.
Interesting.
And so I think like the modeling or the standards piece, I think you've sort of already alluded to, like if you're talking from a coach leading other coaches or from a leader of coaches perspective, like you've talked about like having standards and then living those standards. And then I think modeling passion kind of ties into that as well. But then I think the other parts, like the focus, the commitment, the resilience, I think is a lot about what you show. What you show is important, and like, and yeah, showing your commitment to the goal, to the overarching goal, as opposed to like you're not doing these things to get on their case or to like push them necessarily. You're doing these things because it's part of a bigger picture. That's kind of how I see it. It's about like commitment to a goal. It's about focus on a goal. When we talk about this determination, so I'm sort of trying to tie it into your question about like
No,
leading other coaches.
but even that, I like that breakdown a lot because I think what good leadership is holding somebody to the standard of what it is they set out to do. So for instance, if a kid says, my goal is to get a Division One scholarship, now all of a sudden there's an associated standard with what everything they'd have to do to make that happen, right? But without having sort of that goal initially, it would be very difficult to like measurably put somebody on a track to do that. Now, is that related to leadership? It's like, well, maybe, like, I mean, understanding what's involved with an end goal, I suppose, is linked to leadership.
I mean, yeah, well, understanding what's involved with an end goal, I mean, I think that's part of like having a vision,
Okay, sure.
right? That's part of like providing the vision. And so if you look at the transactional model, that would be something around inspirational motivation.
Okay.
And if you talk about the caring determination like model, if you want to call it that, that would be somewhere in standards and focus. So I think that's part of it. I think the interesting part comes down to like that piece of holding people accountable, because that's a phrase that you hear all the time, is like, How do you do that in a way that it still feels caring? How do you do that in a way that it still feels like it's their journey, not yours? Right? How do you do that in a way where they feel like, okay, this is what I want. This is not what someone else wants of me.
And I'm thinking as you say that, I mean, there's a big difference between being demanding and being an asshole, and that's like another sort of way that you're breaking this down. But empathy's got to play a really big role in that too, though, right? Where it's like being empathetic towards when you ask somebody to like really work their ass off for an extended period of time, like being empathetic to that it's going to be difficult.
I mean,
So I mean, I okay, please.
I'll just jump in, and then and just to read off my notes, because it means I don't have to come up with my own original thoughts. But on the caring side of things, the researchers identified athlete-centeredness, stability and dependability, adaptive coaching, and shared leadership.
Interesting.
So that was sort of their framework for caring. And so it was, okay, athlete-centeredness is like, putting the athlete's needs first, right? Learner-centered, as we would call it in Tennis Canada terms. Stability and dependability is like doing what you say you're going to do, being emotionally stable. They know what kind of response they're going to get from you. Adaptive coaching is like, adapting to the situation, of course, if they're sick or they're not feeling it or whatever. And then shared leadership is like giving them some level of decision-making power in the process.
As you said, all those four headings, it seems like those are topics that we've talked about throughout many pods, right? Those four. And those are all four headings underneath what, which major heading?
Caring,
The
which
caring.
was part of the caring determination.
Determination, yeah. Okay.
But I think it's, I mean, you could talk about these things till the cows come home, but it's the art or the nuance of, like you said, being demanding without being an asshole, pushing people but having them still appreciate it, knowing when to push, when not to push. I think that stuff is tough. And I think also, I guess I've been reading a lot about this stuff. It doesn't cross my mind until I start talking about it. But I came across the other day, Mike, let's see. I've never said it out loud. I've only read it.
Krzyzewski.
Krzyzewski. There we go. Coach K. That's easier. Krzyzewski, Duke coach. Is he still there or did he
No, he
retire?
retired.
But longtime Duke coach, one of the winningest college basketball coaches of all time, I think, in terms of number of games.
Olympic gold medals.
That's right. Coached Team USA in the Olympics. That's right. And he talked about his only two standards. I think he much prefers the term standards over rules. And his two standards, if I'm remembering correctly, were look me in the eye, or look people in the eye and tell the truth. Those were the only two. It was like, we look each other in the eye, we tell each other the truth. And I'm really interested in this idea of like tell each other the truth. Which sounds like a really stupid sentence when you say it out loud. But
It
I
doesn't
mean, I was
though.
like,
It doesn't though, because
but
people are so full of shit. We're also full of shit. Players are full of shit. Coaches are full of shit.
it's obvious, and oh, for sure. And it's not, but it's not even the full of shit, like, did you do your warm up today? Oh yeah, I did, and you're lying. Like that's lying. But there's also like the lying to yourself, right? That both of us do, coaches and players. There's also the like the unwillingness to tell the truth, because we don't want to hurt people's feelings, or we think that it's a personal thing. I was on court with a player today, and I said like, oh, like you should one you know one thing you could do is take a step back and just like stand a little further back in the court. And she goes, I'm standing more in front here because I decided to do it. I'm doing it on purpose. It helped me win the last 2 points. And so then I was like, that's interesting. And then I was like, yeah, okay, I can see where you're coming from. I think maybe then in this situation, you have to do this. And it forced me to think, like, am I wrong? What's the point that she's making? And so she told me the truth is the point I'm getting at. Is rather than just say, yeah, okay, and then either do what I say or ignore it, she decided to go like, hey, like and instead of just backing down, she said like, hey, I'm doing this for a reason. Like, this is why I'm doing this. And then I told her the truth. Well, oh, you're right. I think this might be this. This might be this. And we went back and forth a little bit. And I said, I think you're right here, actually, for the record. I think I was wrong, at least in this situation. And so we're both kind of telling each other the truth rather than her not backing down and me not backing down and either just not talking about it or getting into an argument. But I mean, that's just one example. But you see this, you see this all the time with people, Or what am I trying to say? That's just one example, but it's also relevant in the bigger picture discussions, whether it's like we said, like, are you really aiming for this goal?
Yeah.
Right. Or are you really committed to do this work? Or nice how are you, how are you feeling today? Can you push yourself more? Can you not push yourself more? Like just, I think the real work gets done when you can have fully open and honest conversations.
100%.
The challenge, of course, is getting to the point where you lay the foundation where that can happen. But
I'll piggyback on that with two thoughts. One is there's that, like that Jordan Peterson quote, which is like, always tell the truth, or at least don't lie. And I think that's an interesting distinction, but it kind of goes hand in hand with what you're saying. And in thinking about the conversation that you had with your athlete today on court, where there's a little bit of pushback, or there's a little bit, we'll say just discussion about a tactic or whatever. I want that for my players. You know what I mean? Like there's one player I've worked with for a long time who was a good national level player, but I always had beef with them because they were just saying yes to everything. It's like, no, but like, if I'm asking you a question about something, it's because I'm generally looking for your impact. So I'd really like to come to an agreement on like how comfortable you might feel doing X, Y, or Z. And sometimes it's cultural, right? There's some cultures where it's like you don't speak back to an adult or you don't speak back to a coach, but it's like that can be detrimental to their development, because it goes back to your original thing in this, which is like, in some aspect, it's like you're not being truthful if you're just a yes man. It's like,
But I think also, 100%. And interestingly, well, I don't know if that's talked about. I was going to say that topic is talked about more than the flip side of it. I don't know if that's true, but there's the flip side of it too, which is the coach, first of all, being willing to be honest and tell the truth, but also the athlete being willing to receive it.
Right.
Right. A lot of great coaches talk about like, I just tell it like it is. Right. I'm going to tell them the truth, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And first of all, I think that's interesting because it's like, there must be a way that they're doing this that, as you said, doesn't make them an asshole.
Yeah.
Right. If they've been successful, because of course anyone can just tell the truth all the time, but is it going to be well received? And so there's the art on the part of the coach to like give that feedback in such a way that it's received positively, but also like the personality and the value system of the athlete to respect the truth and to want the truth is just as important as the athlete is. What I'm saying is it's just as important for the coach to be able to tell the athlete the truth as it is for the athlete to be able to tell the coach the truth.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I had a similar thought, and that comes down to a lot of trust, right? Like, yes, there's gotta be a two-way street or trust there, and to not get ego involved, where I think, okay, sometimes players have egos and I don't think that's a bad thing, but I think it's more common to see coaches at a high level that have egos. And like coaches who can be told something by an athlete and kind of be like, okay, you know? And then this goes back into our definitions of like, you know, if you're a leader and you're one of your core leadership principles is like everyone on the team, every player, we're always developing, but then coaches can be stubborn and hard-headed and don't receive feedback from an athlete that might be valuable. I'm not saying every feedback yet from an athlete is valuable, but there's certainly times like, hey, people are smart, players are smart, and we have a lot to learn from everybody, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But do you think when you reflect on the athletes that you've coached in your coaching career?
Yeah.
I think in my experience, there's some coach player relationships where it's just gelled really well and you feel like you get the work done. It just works really smoothly.
Yeah.
And I don't think, here's what I would say, is I don't think that these athletes all had the same sort of, let's call it on paper profile. In other words, not the same gender, not the same game style, not the same personality, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I think in my experience, as I think about, there's a couple of things, but one of the things that comes to my mind is I think that there was a lot of honesty and openness. We were always able to tell each other the truth and have difficult conversations in both directions.
Yeah.
And I think that made the work so much easier. Yeah. I'm curious for you, if you look, I don't want to bias you, but I just did. But if you look at the coaching relationships that you've had that have been the most, I'm going to use the word efficient, right? Because it doesn't mean necessarily they reached the highest level, but where you felt like work got done at the fastest rate.
Yeah.
What are the similarities that you see?
Yeah, I think like honesty with your athlete back and forth, like, and then the trust level, like there's there's enough evidence to support that, like, what the coach is saying, the athlete buys into, or my athlete buys into, and vice versa. And I think a large part of that too is like the timing in which you tell messages. And I think that's something that the more experienced you are, the more skillful you get, where like you might have, like Zach, you might have this tidbit of information for your player, and like, you know, it's going to be really, really impactful, but you almost have to wait for the right moment to use it, because it's just saying it right away might not be the right time, where it's like, when does the athlete really need that information, or when is that message really going to land the best? So I think in some aspects too, that's skillful coaching, right? It's almost like, yeah, you know, like keeping one in the pocket for when it's the right time to say it. Because really, it's like, it's not always the right time to give feedback. And then what I've noticed from, I've really enjoyed having a role as like facilitating sort of the next group of great Canadian coaches. And it's made me so introspective over the way I communicate, because there's so many times that I'll see a coach who's doing a great job and saying all the right things, but either the players they're working with just didn't understand, or it wasn't the right time for the message. And that's not really the fault of the coach, but it's maybe easier for me to see when I'm looking at something on a video camera than it is for the coach to experience in real time. But those two things have stood out a lot, where like, how often is the message 100% correct, but it's not going to get through because of the timing of it? Now, again, all the time, we segue through and away from sort of conversations. But your initial thing is like, your initial question was sort of, how have I been the most impactful with the players that I've been successful with? And I don't know. I don't know. Like, I mean, it's not,
That's a
like,
good answer, though.
well, but like, sometimes things just work, you know? Sometimes you
No, but I
work and
think
you
you.
communicate well with each other and truthfully.
But I think you gave some good.
I mean, you already sort of answered it already, but if I were to ask you a similar question, would like, how would you elaborate more on the answer that you gave?
Yeah, it's a. Should have been ready for that. I mean, I think the biggest word would be trust. And I think I want to be careful to in saying this, because I worry that it biases me towards thinking that like certain athletes have the quote unquote right personality and others don't. But I think those athletes where it worked the best or was the smoothest had a real just respect. Like I said, I don't like saying those sorts of things, because I just it feels too much like you need to respect me. But like I think those athletes had a real respect for the role of a coach. I don't think that. I Here's my point, is I think that they would have shown that respect to anyone, not just me. Now, I think with those athletes, I went above and beyond, or like I went the extra mile for them in some scenarios and really showed them that I cared for them and I was there for them. And I think that built the sort of foundation of the relationship, right? That built the sort of core of trust. I guess that now we're starting to get some interesting words, because respect and trust definitely fit in there. I think like they had a respect for the coach in the sense that they would make eye contact with you, tell you the truth, listen to your feedback, try to implement your feedback. And then there was sort of this foundation of trust that was built, but both through time and through like difficult experiences and conversations and through me putting in the extra work and going the extra mile that showed them that I cared. And I think like the respect and the trust then led to a lot of, as we said, open and honest communication. What I've said to athletes before is I actually think that if it's done right, coaching and like player development can be very easy, at least the on-court stuff.
I agree with that.
Because and of course it isn't really, but in a sense it is. And the point that I would make to them is if we do this really properly, what's going to happen is you're going to try something. I'm going to give you feedback. And then if you go out and try the feedback with your maximum effort and focus immediately, we're going to find out pretty quick if it works or if it doesn't. And it might not, because I'm not perfect. Every player is different.
100%.
But if it doesn't work, I'm going to have another solution, because I have, you know, I know a thing or two about tennis. Yep. And I'm going to try this. I'm going to suggest something else, and you're going to try that other thing. Or maybe you're going to come up with something and you're going to try it. And it's either going to work or it's not. And if you try it really hard and focus on it for a long time, then, you know, we find the right solution, we do it, then it works. And then that becomes a part of your game. And then we go on to the next thing. But like, that's simple. Now, of course, it's an oversimplification and there's more to it. But like, that process right there can be so efficient and so smooth. But I think a lot of the time what happens is, you know, the athlete either, you know, if through, you know, through fault of the athlete or of the coach, but like the athlete either doesn't take the feedback, they don't totally buy into it. Maybe they don't work on it 100% with maximum effort. Maybe they only work on it for 2 minutes and then they move on to something else, or they're not enough time. And then that whole process gets kind of muddied, instead of being very systematic and going, I'm working on this, let's try it. Okay, the coach said this, let me do this. I have an idea, can I try it? Yes, let's do that. Like, that was the point that I tried to make to some athletes,
yeah,
sort of based on my experience with these other athletes, where it already worked like that. There was such a trust that we could both say to each other, I think I'm going to try this. And we go, okay, let's try it. Yep. Whoever had the idea, more often than not, it's the coach. Of course, the coach has more experience. But if the athlete says, I want to try playing like this, I want to try doing this on my backhand or whatever, let's try it. We work on it. What do we think? We discuss. And then we move on. And then it just becomes this really easy decision-making process.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, okay, it is an oversimplification, but it's really not. Like, that's just what coaching is. And then anecdotally, well, there's, okay, the story back in the day when I was doing coach education stuff, we'd always have about 10 minutes to run through whatever it is we were training as in the role of a coach. So it's like, here's your topic, go make this player better at it in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that for the series of a course. And then one of the facilitators of this course at the end was like, hey, does this feel different than coaching in your real environment? And he's like, no. And he's like, well, good, because like, within 10 minutes, if you're very specific on what you're doing and you have a buy-in from your player, you should be able to make something better. Like, you should be able to improve it in that amount of time. And oversimplification or not, it's like, that's just the way stuff works. I've said in this pod before too, that I think there's certain players that as a coach, I'm not a good fit for. And I'm thinking about that as you're going through these definitions, because I think it's like, your values have to really align with your player, like the values of respect or the values of like, me personally, like I want to work with players who value a coach, you know, and value that a coach is there to help make you better. And again, that's a simple thing to say, but there's a lot of players that don't value that, you know? And I had one final thought that's escaping my mind right now. Oh, the only last thing I'd say on that too, which sort of echoes this, is like, I also don't expect players to just, overtly or outrightly just trust me in everything that I say. So there's certainly a period of time in which I need to sell things effectively, or my track record is such that a player should need less of a sell because of potentially my experience or your experience or anybody else. But I will say the most impactful thing, I was working with an athlete who is a year and a half ago who had an ATP ranking. And so our first session on court, I guess, was evaluating for the first half an hour. And after the first half an hour, he asked me a question and I gave him an option for how he might solve something. And I got lucky and it worked really well. And I've never needed to sell anything to this player since that. Like, since that moment, he's like, I'm all in. I asked you a question. You made me better. I trust you. And so like, also being correct can help with players trusting you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I used to think of it as this sort of cycle, right? Where it's like, if you make someone better, they trust you more. That trust makes it easier to make them better the next time. And then if you make them better, they trust you more. And it sort of, it feeds itself. And you just have to get your foot in the door that first time. And if you can do a really good job those first few times, and that's where just being, as you said, like I used to call it, like just being a good coach, like just being able to make someone better, like being really good on court, choosing the right drills, choosing the right teaching points, choosing the right progressions or whatever it is that you're doing. But like, just doing that stuff really well, if you can sort of sometimes force them through it for the first time and then they come out of it going, oh yeah, I'm better, and then it's like, okay, like I've had that exact experience that you're talking about, and then they go like, oh yeah, okay, I see how this works, I trust you, like I've been through it, it worked, I get it now.
Question for you on that. I've always had this mindset that like really good coaching results in the player one day no longer needing the coach. And I think, like, in an after school special sort of way, that's kind of beautiful. But then when I think about it, like, is that really the case though? Like, is that like, when does a player ever not really need the coach? You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the you can certainly make the argument, although who knows with all the rule changes, but you can certainly make the argument that you want to coach them to the point where they don't need you in competition, right? Because I mean, as it stands, there's still plenty of events where you're not allowed to coach. Whether or not that rule is enforced or followed is a different story, but like in theory, there's situations, or even when they're on the road, they're without a coach or whatever, they need to be able to compete without you. So there are plenty of situations where that happens, and so you want to be able to do that. But in terms of the bigger picture, needing a coach, yeah, I'm not so sure that that's at all true. And that's also this, yeah, this interesting thing about what is the end goal? If they are, I mean, like virtually every professional athlete, at least in tennis, I won't talk about sports, I don't know, but like virtually every professional tennis player at the highest end of the game where finances aren't an issue and so on and so forth has a coach. And so it's like, are they dependent on a coach? Is that a bad thing? Like that they're not autonomous enough and they can't do it? It's like, no, they see the value in it. Coaches maximize your performance. So I think in that sense, it's silly to say, okay, I want to coach myself out of a job, but it's also something I've said before. So it's a an alluring catchphrase.
Yeah, for sure. Makes you sound cool. So, can I tell you, and the reason this conversation is interesting is because Tennis Canada overall and their coach ed department has tried to change a lot of their philosophies around coach education, where if they, and maybe I'm speaking out of turn a little bit, but let's say that the collective group of coach ed educators in Canada have, like, well, at the end of a course, our coaching candidates always sort of get the on-court content. You know what I mean? Like, they can always pass these evaluations to be able to do what is required for X certification. But not everyone that has maybe a coach two or a coach three is the same coach. And we don't want every coach to be the same. But what are the differences between the people who come out of a coach two or a coach three or a coach four? And they're really, really impactful. And like they own the stuff and they make people better, like they beat randomness with it. And what's the difference between a coach that just gets certification and then goes back to doing whatever? And so I'm allowed to share these now because they're public. But Tennis Canada has developed the five C's of coaching.
I don't think they developed them. I think because I came across them before, because it was that consultancy group that worked with TC on the whole player development pathway.
Oh, interesting. So
What's
it
it called?
wasn't.
FSQ, I think it's called, by
I'm not
Matt
sure.
Young and another guy who runs that.
Okay, I was going to bring this like a TC brainchild thing, but
I'm all
okay,
I now
either
I don't
way.
want to speak out of turn, but I'm pretty sure. Anyway, but go ahead.
So the things that they have characterized as being the big differentiating factors of the five C's are culture, character, confidence, connection, and competence. So I can repeat them again if you'd like, but it's like
That's what
this whole,
the go back 15 seconds button is for.
yeah, right. This whole pod that we've been on now, essentially all we've done is like just mentioned words and like adjectives or expressions have been like, yeah, that's important, that's impactful. But these five aren't that dissimilar from the original sort of thoughts that you were mentioning at the top of the chart, right? And then how does that relate to you said there's this sort of the study about all of the coaches who have repeatedly produced championships and gold medals and whatever else. So I'd be curious if they embodied those things all the time, or how closely they link between the study and sort of these adjectives, you know?
It's really interesting. I mean, I think there would be a lot of overlap, and it might just depend on how you look at things. I'm not done digging through all of the Mallet and Bersiol research. I've watched a couple of presentations. I've read a couple of articles. I'm working my way through. There's a book that's just out, by the way, if anyone wants to buy it. I think it's called Learning from Serial Winning Coaches. So all I can do is go off of my notes and my sort of surface level understanding of their research. But one of the things that they talk about is there's sort of another one of their sort of summaries of these elite coaches was what they just phrased people, vision, environment.
Right.
That was just what they talked about. And so it was like the people skills, the ability to get buy-in, the ability to be a leader, the ability to cultivate relationships, the vision side to paint a really clear picture and to get people on board, and then the environment, creating the right culture, the right values, the right behaviors that drive that success. And so I think that overlaps quite a lot if we look at like culture, character, connection, we look at those sorts of things. I think there's a lot of overlap. It's interesting when you look at those five, it's obvious to me which one we spend the most time discussing in coach education.
100%. Which one do you think it is?
Yeah, let's make sure we're both on the same page when we say it's obvious. But for me, it's competence.
100%. Yeah.
Right. And that's probably a bad thing, but there's no one necessarily to blame for that. It's understandable because it's much easier to measure, first of all. Okay, they hit 4 out of 10. Now they hit 6 out of 10. That's progress. You could sometimes put a video camera on it and look, their technique changed from this to this, right? It's also, I would say, quite a lot easier to it's much more understood how to build competence. We know a lot more about motor skill acquisition and teaching and all these things than we do about building confidence and connection, character, culture. Of course, we know stuff about, I'm not saying it's a black hole. We know stuff about those things, but we know less. So I think that's interesting. And I know I'm not the first person to point that out by any stretch of the imagination. That's a thought that I've stolen from other people, but it's interesting. Like that's where we spend the most time in coach education. I think sometimes that's where we spend the most time as coaches reflecting. And I'm going to throw one wrench in the works here. It might be the right approach. Because we just, I don't think it is, but it might be because we just talked about the value that being a good coach can have on getting someone's trust, right? You give it the right piece of feedback at the right moment, you do the right exercise, they get better and they go, hey, I see the value that you can bring. So being a competent coach is also very valuable. And I mean, it's valuable to them because they want to get better. It's valuable to you in terms of building that trust and building those other C's. So it's a bit of a balance because I think, I mean, that's why they're all five are there, but you can't go without either one. I think like you can be this amazing leader and talk about build a great culture, character, confidence, connection, all these things. If you don't have the competence piece, they're not going to get better as quickly as they could. And on the flip side, of course, as we know, if you're competent, but you don't build the right environment and all those things, the relationships, then it struggles as well. So, I mean, they're all very important. That's
No, but I mean, I would make the
my
argument.
summary. Hey guys, they're all important.
Go team. No, but I mean, I would make the argument that competence probably is the most important one in some aspect, right? And we'd have to dive deeper into this for sure. But anyway, it's interesting, man. It's all interesting stuff. And I will finish this part with an anecdotal story about a gentleman, a coach that I have met on international travels, who is just a really high character guy. Like he's so nice. He's so cool. And hanging around and like his connection to people, like he's the coach who's like going to all the breakfast tables, like, hey everybody, hey, good luck today. How you doing? Like he's so good with that. It seems like he's surrounded himself with like this great culture because he's surrounded by other people that like share his values. But it's funny because he posts so many videos online with like some prominent players and for some prominent organizations and. The competence part, in my opinion, is just so low. Like he doesn't like he okay, by my standards and probably your standards, he doesn't really have a clue. But he's so confident that his players get great results. And like there he has all these other qualities that allow his players to be successful. And I just find that's like fascinating. Because there was one time that you talked about who was Tommy Paul's coach now?
Brad
Brad
Stein.
Stein. And I remember you had, and I don't know if you said this on the pod or off the pod, but you talked about sort of like a coming to Jesus moment where just like, you know what? Brad Stein's an excellent coach. Even if he doesn't use the same terminology as me, or he doesn't have the same pedagogy as me, but like, look at his results. He's a great coach. And I think that's interesting.
Absolutely. And can you, well, first of all, I'm dying to know who this coach is. But the second of all is not to go, beat a dead horse and keep going on the same topic,
Beat
but
it.
like,
Beat it. Kill that horse.
is there something about him that you feel like this is why he's so motivational, so inspirational? Builds that culture? Is it just enthusiasm? The picture I have in my head is a very enthusiastic, positive person, just from the way you've described it. But like, is it just that, or do you feel like is it just being a good schmoozer and having good social skills, or like, hard to
I
say, I
think
guess.
it's a lot of those things. It's tough to know. I mean, listen, I'm not that close to the guy, but he just like I go back to the confidence thing. He just exudes confidence. Like when he's at these events, he's walking around as if, and he's putting on the persona that he is by far the strongest coach out of anybody there, and that he has something to teach everybody, and he would be so excited to help you understand things the way that he does. And I don't mean any of that negatively. Like it's really interesting.
I was just going to say, does it come across as arrogant?
It does not, though. That's what's so interesting about it is like, it's not like people don't talk shit about him because everybody likes him. So like likability maybe is another thing you throw in there, but it's so interesting, so interesting
That's
guy.
really interesting. Good stuff, man.
All right.
Got a plug to make. As some listeners know, I'm completing my master's of education in high performance coaching and technical leadership. I am doing my final research project on anxiety and choking in junior tennis players, and I need your help, you, the listener, potentially. I am studying junior competitive tennis players aged 13 to 18 who have played at least five tournaments in the last 6 months. They have to be Canadian or Swedish. If you coach a player like that, 13 to 18, five tournaments in the last 6 months, Canadian or Swedish, I need you. There's a survey for them to fill out. It takes 15 minutes. It's very easy. However, I need their parents' consent to fill it out. So, here's the link. Get ready. Get a pen, get a paper. People don't do that anymore.
Tattoo it.
bit.ly, that's bit.ly/choking study. bit.bit.ly/choking study, in case you didn't know how to spell choking study. That is the link to give to the parent. They just give their consent. It takes 30 seconds. And then they get a link. They give it to their child. The child fills out the survey and they're done. Their child's name will not be collected. Their year of birth and their ranking will. But their IP address doesn't get collected. Their email address doesn't get collected. Their name doesn't get collected. And I'm the only person who looks at it. Individual data doesn't get shared with anyone. It's only the researchers that look at the data en masse to do the analysis. Please, if you are coaching anyone that fits that description, send their parent the link, ask them to get their kid to fill it out. I very much appreciate it. Otherwise, I will not graduate. I will be broke without a degree, and the last 3 years will have been a waste. So, yeah.
Do it for Zach. Hey,
Do
good
it
luck
for
finding
Zach.
kids in Canada who've played five tournaments over the last 6 months.
Zinger.
Wrong demographic,
Had
probably.
to get that
Yeah, I guess I had to. I had to.
one in,
All right, well, y'all. Well, this has been the Gray Zone. Have a very gray day.
We love it. Al, thanks for podding with me.
Have a two, Zach. See you in a couple months.
Oh, I hated that. I'm doing that again. Thanks for listening. That was the Gray Zone.